chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest my dab in the middle of it. Rest my dab in the middle. We are. Rest my dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to start off this first hour with a pronouncement and a briefing by John Bound. And he was really upset about this Restrict Act. He sets it out and says it like it is. So here we're going to go with John Bound.
Is Senator Lindsey Graham a liar or incompetent or both?
You got to be kidding me, Senator. Did you read this?
Yeah, I don't think I support the Restrict Act.
You don't support this because you were named as one of the supporters, because this is garbage.
Is this the one with John? There's two bills out there. One allows a review of businesses that are connected to China, give the secretary the ability to protect their data. Is that the Restrict Act?
Sure. Congressional staffers get legislation co-sponsored with a rubber stamp all the time as senators line their pockets over lunch with lobbyists. But hours before Graham appeared on Jesse Waters, the news had broken on the treasonous Restrict Act, deceptively presented by its supposed author, Virginia Democrat Senator Mark Warner, that Graham and 11 Democrats and 10 other Republicans co-sponsored.
The problem is real with China, but the solution can be more damaging than the problem.
I agree.
Is sort of what you're telling me.
You know, don't
That's
push
what
back
you're telling me.
On the United States citizens.
Yeah, no, I understand
for something
what you're
China's
saying.
Doing. All right.
Yeah, I totally get that. And constitutionally, we can't do all the things you just said.
The language in the bill reads like a George Orwell novel, crushing the First and Fourth Amendments with doublespeak aimed at foreign adversaries, while awarding sweeping powers to Biden's Secretary of Commerce to set in motion the rounding up of those standing in the way of the compromised Biden administration's New World Order directives.
To be clear, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer. I am a MacBook repairman, and I am pulling this out of my ass at 1 a.m. in a chair that got scratched up by a cat. But like, it is the purpose of this act to provide the public with such information while protecting the rights of individuals and the ability of the government to carry out its responsibilities. So what it's saying is that this act is not subject to Section 551, 553 through 559, and Section 701 through 707 of Title V United States Code, aka Freedom of Information Requests. We have laws that have been passed to try and limit the influence that lobbyists and corporations have over our government. Those do not apply to this. We have laws that allow the citizens of the country to be able to ask for information from their government regarding decision-making processes, to be able to get access to documents and things that, you know, they kind of paid for as taxpayers, to understand how the government is making the decisions. And that doesn't apply here either. Covered transaction means a transaction which an entity describes in subparagraph B has any interest, including through an interest in a contract for the provision of technology or service or any such class of transactions. So like a covered transaction in this case could literally be that you host a website. Are you undermining a democratic institution, or are you just saying something that is counter to the narrative that's currently being set? This is scary, and we have enough information. We are at a time that is politically charged enough that you bet your ass that this is going to be misused.
Unleashing enforcement by an AI-driven surveillance state, while by seeming coincidence, major banks continue to fall like dominoes to the coming digital currency maelstrom. As Congress continues its theater of combating Chinese data harvesting, the architecture of the American surveillance state is set in stone. WikiLeaks published the CIA's Vault 7 documents back in 2017, detailing the malware tools developed by the agency's operations support branch to compromise smart devices, operating systems, most web browsers, and smartphones. While the artificial intelligence, poised to police those who seek the truth, is so far advanced that tech leaders are now calling to pause AI development because it poses too big a threat. Currently, the Restrict Act and a similar bill policing election interference in the House, known as the Data Act, have barely met any resistance. If the bills pass, a 21st century cyber Stasi will be given carte blanche to infiltrate any form of internet technology deemed fit, silencing and imprisoning dissent in jackbooted situations that will make Ruby Ridge and Waco look antiquated.
I told Randy, I said, you don't really understand what the full weight and power of this government is and what it would really mean if you want a confrontation with it. I think I used the term that it's like a locomotive. Once you get it rolling down the tracks, it's hard to stop.
While ushering in a Bohemian Grove-inspired nightmare of tyranny and perversion as our children are openly preyed upon and transgender petty tyrants keep the remaining population under Agenda 2030 submission, contact your representative right now before self-government becomes a thing of the past. John Bound reporting.
Glenn Beck was on Tucker Carlson's show just recently, and he laid out a series of pronouncements and warnings, and it was just devastating. But we're going to go with that, and then we're going to get back on the Restrict Act that Tucker, you know, covered earlier in the week. But here we go with Glenn Beck on Tucker Carlson's show.
So when the history of cable news is written, assuming anyone bothers to write it, but if it ever is written, Glenn Beck will have his own chapter as possibly the greatest synthesizer of big ideas ever to appear on camera. And a lot of people made fun of Glenn Beck over the years for that, but if you go back and watch the tape, you will find out that maybe more than any other person on television, Glenn Beck got it right again and again and again. So we thought tonight is the perfect opportunity to hear from him. He's the co-founder of Blaze Media. He's just written a book called The Great Reset, and he joins us now for an overview of what we're watching. Glenn Beck, thank you so much for coming on tonight. How would you interpret this? Well, it's true.
So let me, I've got a couple of things here for you. Let me just go through. I'm going to bring a different perspective to this. We have the banking crisis. They say it's fine. It's just beginning. Yesterday we had the Saudis and, Brazil and, China enter a deal to where the petrodollar is over. Brazil and China are going to trade in their own currency. That's the beginning of the end of our currency. That means a dollar collapse. That Yes. means we become Venezuela. We will have war with China. We will have war with Russia and Iran. We have the Restrict Bill. We have social media and our NSA and everybody else in bed with each other, silencing people. We, of course, have the raccoon dogs, which we all know is bullcrap. And now this week we have a new gun grab that they're trying to do. Biden and his family taking money from the Chinese. What do you think this Donald Trump thing is really all about? The America that we knew, the fundamental transformation that started in 2008, is finished. We are no longer viewed as a superpower. We are now an elderly, we're Joe Biden, just walking into the twilight. What this is all about, I believe, is trying to inflame this country. They've wanted violence from the right from the beginning. They can't yeah. wait it. They need it. Because if we strike out, look at January 6th, the day they're letting the shaman out of prison because it was all trumped up. Thank you, Tucker Carlson, for revealing this. The day they're letting him out, they do this to Donald Trump. They want you to strike out. Why? Because then they can close the cage. I'm going to make another prediction for you, Tucker. You said I got it right. Well, everything I've been talking about since 08, this is the time. I'm going to make a prediction. By 2025, we are going to be at war. We are going to have a new dollar, a currency that probably is coming from the central bank. We'll have a currency collapse, and we will live in a virtual police state. I know that might sound crazy to a lot of people. It's not far off. The Bill of Rights is gone. Nobody is paying attention. Where are the Republicans? Where are the decent Democrats that can see this is insanity? Donald Trump, the reason why this is going to help Donald Trump, and that's why I don't think they're doing it so he can't run. They're doing it because they want people to strike out. Please turn to God, repent, pray for our country, pray for peace. Put on the full armor of God. But here's what's really what they miss. Donald Trump is not even a person anymore. He is a symbol. He is a symbol of the average everyday guy that keeps getting screwed every single time. Watches other people screw up big banks, screw up their companies, and get away with it. They see people all the time doing stuff that they know if they did, they'd be in prison for 20 years. But because they're not part of the elite, they get away with it. Donald Trump has taken arrow after arrow, and that's why this is the way the average American feels tonight.
Yeah.
I hope that there's a few Democrats out there, but this guy has been taking the bullets for the average person now for years. And people on the right feel like he's the only guy that really gets what the people are feeling. And it's not gonna end well for the Democrats in the next election. It's just not. I don't know if Donald Trump is the winner or not, but I will tell you this: you're not going to stop 100 million people. This country is in shambles. And there's going to be 100 million people that will walk on broken glass and through fire to vote for someone other than this corrupt banana republic administration.
That's, I think, exactly right. Glenn Beck, wow. I'm going to be processing that for a couple of days. I really appreciate your coming on tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Tucker. Thank you.
Next is what Tucker Carlson had to say earlier in the week. And I believe it was on Monday night, and he set off a storm of controversy on this Restrict Act. This Restrict Act is nothing but unconstitutional police state lockdown. That's all it is. It's no good. Vote against Restrict Act. Get everybody out there to talk it down. And Lindsey Graham and those people and Warner out of Connecticut, they're all behind it. Get against the Restrict Act. It's unconstitutional, un-American. But here we go with what Tucker Carlson said Monday night.
Every day, more than 2 billion people use a social media app called TikTok. Many of them are young people under the age of 24. If you had kids, you probably know already how TikTok works. TikTok lets users upload short videos. Usually they're under 30 seconds. What's interesting is that the content of these videos varies a lot depending upon what country you're in. If you're in China, where TikTok is headquartered, you tend to get more educational content. But if you live in this country, you get an awful lot of filth and propaganda tailored for kids. We're not guessing about this. We ran an experiment to prove it last summer. Watch. The TikTok that Chinese residents, children in China, get to see is very different from the one your kids are looking at here. Now, in China, where TikTok is known under a different name, videos like these are very common. Watch. Legends never die. They become a part of you. Some young bucks need the war. Nations are local. You know what American kids, your kids, are watching on TikTok? Stuff like this. Well, that's kind of weird. Can you see what's going on here? Well, China does. They run TikTok. And China knows if you want a productive society that extends beyond, say, next week, you teach your kids about hard work and creativity and personal responsibility, respect for authority. But if you want to destroy a society, you funnel a ton of garbage to kids about gender ideology and twerking. As the account Libs of TikTok has documented extensively, that's exactly what TikTok is doing here. There's a whole genre of videos of teachers boasting about indoctrinating kids.
I have had multiple students come out to me, not just with their sexuality, but also with their gender identity. It's one of the reasons I think it's so important to be out and loud and proud.
I teach my elementary school students about gender identity. Some people are girls, some are boys, some are both, some are neither.
I might tell this kid, we do have a flag in the class that you can pledge your allegiance to. And he like looks around and he goes, oh, that one?
So it goes without saying that net net, as they say, TikTok is not a positive influence on American society. And right now, in response to criticism of TikTok, China's government and the company itself are doing the same thing they did when they responded to allegations of a lab leak in Wuhan. They're saying anyone who raises questions is a racist. And they're doing that everywhere across the media. And they can because a lot of the news that you consume is paid for by TikTok. Politico, a completely ideologically corrupt organization in Northern Virginia, has a so-called playbook that is sponsored by TikTok every other week. CNN, meanwhile, just put its tech reporter on the air to inform you that criticizing TikTok opens up Chinese Americans to, quote, hate and violence. If you criticize TikTok, you're killing Asian people. So, confronted with all this, you might support efforts in the Congress right now to ban TikTok altogether. And a lot of people do, not just on the right, but also on the left, which is kind of interesting. This is one of those weird moments where there's, or appears to be, some kind of bipartisan consensus. And that alone might want to make you pause for a second. If everyone in power is saying the same thing, is it really a good idea? Let's take a closer look. And again, this is not a defense of TikTok, merely an acknowledgement of what's actually happening in Washington right now. So one of the bills that would ban TikTok is being pushed, as we said, by senators in both parties. It's called the Restrict Act. Mark Warner of Virginia and John Thune of South Dakota, Democrat and Republican, introduced this legislation. Now, the bill is ostensibly about protecting American national security and ending, quote, foreign adversaries from interfering in our elections through apps like TikTok. Because, of course, election interference by Twitter and Facebook is no problem at all. But election interference from TikTok is totally unacceptable. Okay. But in reality, and you should know this if you're opposed to TikTok, as we are, this bill isn't really about banning TikTok. It's never about what they say it is. Instead, this bill would give enormous and terrifying new powers to the federal government to punish American citizens and regulate how they communicate with one another. For example, the bill would regulate, quote, certain transactions between persons in the United States and foreign adversaries. Now, what's a foreign adversary and who gets to decide? Oh, well, the Secretary of Commerce and the DNI, not the Congress, get to decide what foreign adversaries are. Well, that ought to trip a switch in your brain. And then the transactions with foreign adversaries would include, quote, any acquisition, importation, transfer, installation, dealing in, or use of any information and communications technology product or service, including ongoing activities such as mandated services, data transmission, software updates, repairs, or the provision of data hosting services. Well, that's pretty broad. Under this bill, if you engage in any of that with a so-called foreign adversary, as determined by, in this case, the Biden administration, that would allow the Secretary of Commerce, Gina Raimondo, and the Director of National Intelligence, April Haynes, to decide whether you're acting in the, quote, interest of a foreign adversary. Again, that's another term that the executive branch, the Secretary of Commerce, gets to define without the interference of Congress. So if the Biden administration decides that you're doing this, then the Secretary of Commerce can then enforce, quote, any mitigation measure to address any risk arising from any covered transaction with any person or with respect to any property subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. These covered transactions can involve, quote, current, past, or potential future transactions. And the mitigation measures include, but are not limited to, throwing American citizens in prison for 20 years. Think about that for a minute. So you would be allowing the executive branch, the Biden administration, to regulate speech on the internet. And if you are somehow involved with a, quote, foreign adversary, or let's say you oppose the war against Russia, you go to prison for 20 years. So this isn't about banning TikTok. This is about introducing flat-out totalitarianism into our system. Now, just because TikTok is so unappealing, just because it's a creepy, low-IQ Chinese plot designed to make our kids trans, and it is, that does not mean that the people trying to ban TikTok have your interests in mind. Oh, it definitely doesn't, or America's. Keep in mind, these are exactly the same people who drained our strategic petroleum reserve and, in fact, promote China at every turn. Now they're telling you they're against China. They're not. This is not an effort to push back against China. It's part of a strategy to make America much more like China, with the government in charge of what you read and see, and with terrifying punitive powers at their fingertips. Now, we've seen this before from the national security state again and again. Confronted with a foreign adversary, for example, after 9/11, the federal government uses the opportunity to expand their police powers over the American population. And they do it under false pretexts, and they do it quickly, by whipping people into a panic. Usually that's rooted in some truth. TikTok is bad, sure. Al-Qaeda was terrible, of course. But these measures are not aimed at stopping the foreign threat. They're aimed at controlling the American population, and they rush it through. And they do it so quickly that no one ever explains how exactly does this preserve American national security. Now, according to Sandy Cortez, we really quote her, Congress has not even been briefed on any of this. Watch.
Usually when the United States is proposing a very major move that has something to do with significant risk to national security, one of the first things that happens is that Congress receives a classified briefing. And I can tell you that Congress has not received a classified briefing around the allegations of national security risks regarding TikTok. So why would we be proposing a ban regarding such a significant issue without being clued in on this at all? It just doesn't feel right.
Okay, so again, in case you think we've gone crazy and we're defending Sandy Cortez, we should point out that she is a tool of the national security state. She's out promoting a war against Russia, and anyone who asks questions is an ally of Putin. And she's probably acting for motives that we find, well, abhorrent. But the question that she raises is real, and we want to be honest enough to say that. This may be one of those times, and they're common in Washington, where the solution has nothing to do with the problem, and in fact degrades our free country and makes it something unrecognizable.
Laura Ingraham elaborated on one of her programs this week, too, about Restrict Act and several other things. I think she touched on this indictment on Trump and so forth. But here's what she said about that, and she's really a stand-up lady. Laura Ingraham, here we go.
Hunting Trump, destroying America. That's the focus of tonight's angle. Now, the left has wanted to put Donald Trump in jail since 2015, and today Democrats have gotten them closer to that goal. And let's be very clear, the White House is the key player in this game of political vengeance. Now, sure, they're officially saying no comment when they're asked about Alvin Bragg's indictment of President Trump. But make no mistake tonight, Joe Biden bears the ultimate responsibility for what this will do to America. Now, our nation's chief executive has the inherent duty to do everything he or she can to preserve America's standing in the world as the world's leading democracy. Now, that means, whether through back channels or public speeches, Biden should have made it very clear that his party would oppose any local prosecutor who uses trumped-up criminal charges to punish and humiliate a former president. But, of course, Biden didn't do this. Instead, once again, he bowed to the far left, which has been salivating over the prospect of Trump and a mugshot for years.
A lot of Democrats spouting off, saying that they think Trump should go to jail.
President Trump himself could end up being prosecuted.
Once he becomes a civilian, Donald Trump may have to go to court and could possibly go to jail.
People who know Donald Trump's conduct have long said he belongs in jail.
He could go to jail for up to 4 years.
And tonight, many on the left are gloating. You've read them on social media. And they're not considering, though, what this is going to do to our country. Tens of millions of Americans, maybe half the country, will come away from this sad saga with less faith in our justice system. They're going to believe that if you hold one set of political views, you'll be targeted. But if you hold another set of political views, you'll be protected. Americans will start believing that the principle of equal justice under the law is frankly a joke, because they're going to see the justice system as rigged. An America where prosecutors who wield enormous power are just political hacks? Alvin Bragg is no different from any of the hosts, for instance, on MSNBC. For them, it's get Trump or go home. We all know that if Trump had quietly retired from politics after the last election, he wouldn't be facing an indictment tonight. He wouldn't be facing any investigation in Georgia or by a special prosecutor in D.C. either. Going forward, when any American president or diplomat speaks out against, let's say, the human and civil rights abuses in Russia or China, well, those countries are just going to respond with, "You're lecturing us? Nice try, but your system is morally bankrupt. You did everything you could to put one of your own former presidents in prison right before one of your so-called elections." Well, and at that point, given what's happened, who could argue with that? The fact is, Democrats are doing what we've watched tin pot dictatorships and banana republics do throughout history. They made a political decision to try to put their chief political nemesis in jail. And they're indicting him in a state where it's highly unlikely he'll ever get a fair trial. Now, their case was such a loser that the Department of Justice declined to take it, and the Federal Election Commission didn't pursue it either. But now, on the cusp of what will be a fascinating, perhaps competitive GOP primary, 18 months before the presidential election, suddenly, this case is a priority on a state level? Interesting timing. This is a shameful day in the history of the country. This is going to poison our political landscape for years to come. And the entire episode makes Biden out to be a total liar. So tonight, those self-proclaimed defenders of democracy, they've been proven themselves beyond any reasonable doubt to be total frauds. In fact, they've proven themselves to be the ultimate election meddlers. Pursuing a specious criminal case against former President Trump for one reason and one reason only, because they're worried that he might win again. Now, when Biden claimed that he was very concerned about losing democracy in the United States and that he was going to protect it after the 2020 election, he was lying. All along, he knew that the Democrat machine would do everything, everything in its power, shady or not, to keep a populist conservative like Trump away from the levers of power. After Biden was elected, remember how he said he told all the world leaders that America is back? People thought this meant that he was going to bring the country together. But that wasn't ever what he was intending. Instead, he listened to the fringe, the far left who thinks Biden's problem is that he's too nice. They needed to pivot to being an administration of rage, where political opponents aren't just rivals, they're enemies. Enemies to be punished by any means necessary. Now, Biden could have made it clear to Merrick Garland that they should be fair to Republicans at the Justice Department. He could have insisted that the DOJ enforce the laws against protesting at the homes of Supreme Court justices. He could have spoken out against anti-Christian hate and violence. We see that, you've seen it against churches and pro-life centers. And he could have said that if Trump decides to run in 2024, I'll beat him the old-fashioned way. I'll beat him on the issues, because America doesn't jail political opponents. Go back and read Lincoln's second inaugural address. Now, in the midst of an actual bloody civil war. Now, after that, was his speech all about vengeance? Putting Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis in jail? Hell no. It was about how we as a nation needed to come together. It was about reconciliation. Now, no one is saying that we should ignore serious political crimes. But unless there's some bombshell here that's been kept secret all this time, this case is an embarrassment of nothing. No one thinks Trump committed a real crime here. But ironically, the people in New York who do commit real crimes, they get off scot-free, courtesy of the Democrat Party and Alvin Bragg. A healthy, vibrant democracy doesn't jail its political opponents. But the fact is, the Biden administration has been a complete and utter failure on every front. So they'd rather spend the next year and a half sowing division and hatred than selling solutions to all the problems that they created. They don't respect you. They think you're stupid. So they want to eliminate your options at the ballot box by getting rid of Trump. The ultimate in election tampering, isn't it? And they want you and the angle so distracted by this bogus criminal case that we ignore the fact that the U.S. under Biden is spiraling down the drain. Here are just a sampling of some of the stories today that they don't want to talk about. After a transgender killed six at a Christian school, the White House said they were praying for the trans community, while Joe Biden said they are part of the fabric of America. And at the border, we just saw a group of 1,000 illegal immigrants rush across yesterday, as DHS Secretary Mayorkas claims he's unaware that the cartels use situations like that to distract border agents, to bring in guns, drugs, and criminals. You name it. They did it. We have a reeling economy on multiple fronts, inflation persistent, and the banks are floundering. And at China's direction, the world is quickly decoupling from the American dollar. The ramifications will be devastating for America if that continues. So Biden's approval on the economy, what is it, 32%? His overall approval, it's not that much better. Heck, only 25% of Democrats want him to run again. So his conception of democracy is that his family can make a fortune selling us out to China, and anyone who disagrees with him will be subject to the mob intimidation or jail time. As of today, tens of millions of our fellow Americans will never be able to see him as anything but a harsh, selfish partisan who only cares about keeping his grip on power. Every single Republican in office today and tonight should be speaking out against Bragg's Persecution Act. I don't care if you support Trump, you're running against Trump, 2024 or not. It's not really about him in the end. Tonight, the man who is set to be his chief rival in 2024 stepped up to the plate, Ron DeSantis, releasing this statement almost immediately, reading in part, "The weaponization of the legal system to advance a political agenda turns the rule of law on its head. It's un-American. Florida will not assist in the extradition request given the questionable circumstances at issue with this Soros-backed Manhattan prosecutor and his political agenda." Perfect. Bingo. What is happening here should be a warning to DeSantis, or frankly anyone else who may get within striking distance of beating Biden. They should all realize that they'll become a target too. Some prosecutor somewhere will allege something. They fight dirty. These so-called champions of democracy. It's time for us to fight smart. And that's the angle.
Boy, Laura Ingraham, is she stand up lady. Robert Barnes interviewed Alan Dershowitz on key issues of this upcoming trial after this indictment of Trump. And there's some very interesting things. I'll have an embedded full interview on this with Barnes and Alex Jones and Alan Dershowitz. But first, listen to these. Some of these key points are interesting to listen to and know about.
Yeah. Getting back to Burr for a second, you know, Burr, as you know, killed Hamilton in a duel, but he wasn't prosecuted for that. He was actually sitting vice president when that happened, but he was prosecuted years later for treason. He tried to get a verdict of not guilty. The jury returned a verdict of not proven using the Scottish system. He objected to that, and the judge, who was John Marshall, the great Chief Justice of the United States, said, no, you're going to have to be satisfied with the verdict of not proven. But that trial, and then I would say some of the McCarthy trials, some of the civil rights trials, are the greatest trials in American history, the Rosenberg trial. There are so many. This is going to rank among them if it ever gets to trial. It's a strong possibility. It won't get the trial. It'll be dismissed on statute of limitations or other grounds. But, you know, it might get the trial. And if it gets the trial in Manhattan, he probably will be convicted. And then it'll have to go up to appellate courts. And appellate judges in New York are also elected. And so it may have to wait to get into the federal courts and up to the Supreme Court, but my prediction is in the end, if the indictment is what we think it is, it will not survive.
There has been some talk, Professor, about the possibility of issuing a gag order. That I see this as misuse of bail authority, a violation of First Amendment principles. Can you just tell people why there's constitutional limits on such a gag order, why it should not apply here, and what's the risk that the political pressure in New York leads a judge to issue that kind of gag order?
It's possible. Gag orders like this have been issued in the past. They are, in my view, unconstitutional. We have to take seriously the notion that every American is presumed innocent unless and until they're found guilty by a jury. And innocent people can't be denied their First Amendment rights. By the way, it's not only Trump's First Amendment rights. It's the First Amendment right of everybody to listen to what Trump has had to say. And there are millions of people out there who want to hear him say what he has to say. And so I don't think it would be constitutional to impose a gag order or a travel restriction if he's running for president. But, you know, judges have a lot of discretion, and a lot of judges have made a lot of mistakes about bail conditions. And so I hope that when a judge makes the decision, he'll think more about the Constitution than about what his friends will say about his decision.
In the context of Michael Cohen, for a witness who has the, as you note, the extraordinarily poor track record that he does in making contradictory statements, by his own admission, a self-confessed fraudster, by his own admission, a self-confessed liar, by obvious implication, a perjurer. If you were defending the president, how much would you make the reliability or lack thereof of Michael Cohen a key part of the trial strategy?
Oh, it's a very key part of the strategy. When prosecutors put on witnesses that lie and that lie to the jury, juries see through that and don't like it. Look, people credit me and others for winning the O.J. Simpson case. We didn't win the O.J. Simpson case. The prosecutors lost the O.J. Simpson case by putting on lying witnesses, by putting on police officers who tampered with the evidence. The jurors told us that afterward. And so the greatest gift to Donald Trump would be Michael Cohen, the gift that keeps on giving. And so if I'm a smart prosecutor, I don't go near Michael Cohen, but, you know, then the juries will wonder, we're seeing the play Hamlet. Where's the prince? We don't see Hamlet. He's the central character in this thing, and he's not testifying. And so they're going to have to try to explain that. This is not going to be an easy case on the merits for Bragg. It may be an easy case if it's held in Manhattan. If it's held anywhere else, I think it'll be a hard case for him.
Now, do you think that people have a right, of course, to an impartial jury? As you note, that's a very difficult thing to come by in New York City if your name is President Donald John Trump. What can you remind people, what are your constitutional rights, and what would a good judge do to try to find an impartial jury in Manhattan?
Well, I think it would be an impossible task, but he'd have to give the defense an enormous amount of leeway in questioning jurors. And, you know, let's assume you could get 12 jurors who never heard of Donald Trump. What kind of people would they be if they never heard of Donald Trump? Or 12 people who say they have no opinion on Donald Trump. There's one word for that, and that's liars. A lot of potential jurors lie because they want to get on the jury. Everybody wants to be on the jury in the most historic case in modern American history. So you're going to get a lot of people lying about a lot of things in order to get on the jury. I have to tell you, I think it's an impossible job to try to get a fair jury in Manhattan. And I would hope that judges would see that. Now, the motion to get a change of venue is sometimes appealable if that's denied. So it might get to a court of appeals fairly quickly, and a court of appeals might send the case to a different borough or to upstate New York. But we'll see if judges have the courage to do the right thing here. The right thing is to get the case out of Manhattan.
And what do you think, I don't know if you saw recently the federal civil trial that's coming up in New York, where we'll get to see sort of a quick glimpse at what New York justice might look like if you're named Donald Trump. The court has ordered an anonymous jury. I've always been a little concerned about anonymous juries because it can create at least the impression of secret justice. The average person doesn't get to crowdfund or crowdsource, I should say, information that, as in the Roger Stone case, we found out one of the jurors really had not been fully forthcoming during the process. Ghislaine Maxwell's case raised some issues about that as well. What do you think about the possibility of an anonymous jury in the criminal case concerning Donald Trump?
There's no such thing. Anonymous juries are only anonymous during the trial. Their names then get revealed afterward, and their names get leaked. So I don't think an anonymous jury protects. An anonymous jury also sends a message to the jurors, you got something to be worried about. And it reaffirms the notion that if people knew you were on the jury, they might take it out on you either physically or psychologically, emotionally, or in friendship ways. So I don't think an anonymous jury provides much protection. It may provide a little bit of protection. They also may try to get a sequestered jury. But in this case, everybody already knows everything. So sequestering them during the trial won't really provide the kind of fairness that is required to have a fair trial. I just don't think it's possible to have a fair trial. People are going to render verdicts and judgments based on their voting patterns. If they want to see Trump be president, if they don't want to see Trump be president, if they like his presidency in the past and they don't like it, that's not the basis for which justice is supposed to be done.
Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. Robert Barnes here, guest hosting with the one and only, the inimitable Professor Alan Dershowitz, the greatest living constitutional lawyer in our time on matters of criminal law, civil law, and political arena as well, has managed to cover all three in his lifetime. A rare someone that I would like to emulate over my legal career if I get the good fortune to do so. Professor Dershowitz, what about the timing? You know, there's a right to the public has a right to a speedy trial. Trump has a right to a speedy trial. But it may not be in the interest of justice to have a too speedy trial in this case. What do you think the timing is if the case actually ultimately proceeds to a jury trial, if it gets past motions to dismiss and things of that nature? What do you think the timing will be of an actual jury trial in this case?
Hard to believe that there could be a jury trial in this case in this calendar year. I would think that it will occur during the election year, which will make things even more difficult, but the timing was up to Bragg. I think the speedy trial and statute of limitations issues have already expired. I mean, these events occurred 7 years ago. Can he get a fair trial based on the passage of time? And don't statutes of limitations have to be enforced fairly? But I do think that with motions, with possible appeals that could be made of motions, that we're probably thinking about 2024.
In terms of the issues concerning the political weaponization and selective prosecution, does this potentially open the door to Republican prosecutors in, say, some small county somewhere in the country deciding, well, we'll indict Hillary Clinton now. We'll indict, you know, we'll find something to indict Barack Obama on. We'll indict Hunter Biden. We'll indict Joe Biden. What is the risk of that door has now been opened by this prosecution?
Oh, I think the risk is considerable. In America, we have seen over and over again tit-for-tat politics. And anything the Democrats do, the Republicans do, and vice versa. And I do think that we will see more political charges, and we'll see the bar reduced. It used to be the case that you understand that if a person is running for office, you must have a very high bar to prosecute. It has to be a clear case. This, if the indictment is what we think it is, will have violated that rule and lowered the bar, and that lowering of the bar will apply to Republicans, to Democrats, and for everybody. And this is a case that endangers all of our freedoms. If you can bring a criminal case on the basis of this kind of flimsy evidence and law, that means nobody is safe. Justice Jackson once said, excuse me, that any prosecutor can rummage through the statute books and find something to pin on somebody, and that's not the way American law should apply, and that rule, too, has been violated by yesterday's actions.
Yeah, it very much feels like a Berea prosecution. Show me the man and I'll find you the crime. One thing that's always stood out to me throughout this process is you identify in your book Get Trump and have talked about being problematic from the get-go is usually sometimes when you have a high-profile political person saying they're going to go after somebody, it's for something that's already happened in a clear criminal context, like, oh, I'm going to go prosecute Enron or I'm going to go prosecute the white collar or whatever. I'm going to go prosecute that guy. I'm not sure on what yet. But I'm just going to go get that guy. You know, the old famous Berea statement to Stalin, show me the man and I'll find you the crime. The to some degree, to what degree does this raise issues of due process? That if we see the indictment and we see laws being applied in ways that could not have been really on fair notice of most people, as you pointed out very articulately at the beginning, non-disclosure agreements are done all the time. Nobody puts them in their public disclosure later or their internal documents. Oh, by the way, here's my hush money payment. I mean, it defeats the whole purpose of a non-disclosure agreement. Now, all of a sudden, all those people could be criminally prosecuted all across America. How much is there an issue of fair notice and due process that might come up in these proceedings as well?
Well, there's no question. There is an issue of fair notice. There is an issue of what the law calls lenity. When you have ambiguous statutes, they have to be resolved in favor of the defendant. It all goes into the concept of targeting, of get Trump, of due process violations of selective prosecution. All of these will be raised. Some of them are harder than others to get a judicial relief on them, but they are all part of also the court of public opinion. For example, the government's going to argue the statute of limitations didn't get told because he was out of the state, meaning you couldn't indict him if he was in Washington, D.C., but they indicted him when he was out of the state. So that gives the lie to the notion that they couldn't have indicted him any day over the past 7 years. And statute of limitations of misdemeanors, 2 years, felony, 5 years. Those are long expired. Why didn't they indict him while he was outside of the state, or even while he was in the state, which he came to from time to time? And the reason is obvious. Prosecutors looked at the case and they said, there's nothing here. And so they didn't indict him, and now they decided to change that 7 years later. That should not survive a statute of limitations scrutiny, but it might, because the New York Court of Appeals had a weird, weird decision about how you count the days being out of the state. But I don't think that's consistent with what the statute of limitations, which was enacted by the legislature, had in mind.
And can you explain for folks that the statute of limitations isn't just like some little procedural aspect? Sometimes we hear, you know, technicalities, and people use that excuse for how criminal defendants escape as they view justice. In fact, these are constitutional rights and liberties meant to impose fair notice is a critical component of what statute of limitations is all about. And that the rule of lenity, as you mentioned, is about protecting against the defendant being wrongfully prosecuted in a way they couldn't fairly anticipate and how we interpret the laws. Could you remind folks that, you know, what other people call technicalities are the core to constitutional liberty in America?
Well, my life has been a life of trying to impose what other people think are technicalities and I think are the essence of what makes America the greatest democracy in the world, that we have rules of law, and those rules of law have to be enforced fairly and equally. And statutes of limitations are part of them. Look, we're seeing a challenge to statute of limitations. The Me Too movement got many states to eliminate statutes of limitations for rape and other sexual crimes, and that has created major problems because memories disappear, witnesses disappear, and statutes of limitations have to be taken seriously. And I don't think any crime other than perhaps murder should be prosecuted beyond a certain period of time, 5 years, something like that. But they certainly shouldn't be extended after the statute of limitations has expired. The Supreme Court has said that would be unconstitutional. So there is a constitutional dimension to statute of limitations.
Have you been surprised? I've been surprised to some degree at many of my friends on the left, in particular, but not limited to it, within the legal world, have, in my view, abandoned a lot of their principles, either because of political pressure or because of just like Trump derangement syndrome and the rest. Have you been surprised at seeing that? And are you, while you predicted it in Get Trump and forecast this is where the world was going, are you still surprised that we're actually here? We're to this point.
I am. I'm disappointed. In my previous book, The Price of Principle, I talked about how so many civil libertarians, people like my former colleague Lawrence Tribe, and the ACLU are prepared to give up on the Constitution in order to get Trump. And I've had people say that to me. We're prepared to do anything, distort any constitutional provision, ignore any rule of law if we can get Trump. And that's why the subtitle for my book, Get Trump, is The Threat to Civil Liberties, Due Process, and Our Constitutional Rule of Law. It's not only a threat to Trump. It's not only a threat to people who get indicted. It's a threat to have the rule of law subordinated to the preference of politics. And I think we're seeing more and more and more of that. There's less respect for the Constitution. And people on the hard left, particularly in the woke movement, have said over and over again, we don't care about freedom of speech. We don't care about due process. We know the truth. We know if you're a man who's been accused by a woman, you have to be guilty. What do you need a trial for? What do you need due process? We know if you're somebody who makes statements that are sexist or racist, there's no room for that under our First Amendment. We don't need to hear your point of view. That's what happened in Stanford when a group of people from the National Lawyers Guild organized an attempt to try to shut down and silence a federal judge whose views they disagreed with. National Lawyers Guild is going to do that all over the country at 100 law schools where they have organizations. And so we have to fight back for every one of our amendments. Look, if I were writing the Bill of Rights, I might not put the Second Amendment in, certainly not in the ambiguous terms that it's there today, but it's there. And we have to fight to preserve it, just like we have to fight to preserve the Fifth Amendment and the First Amendment. That's the basis of our democracy. The Bill of Rights is a constraint on majority rule, and we have to keep that viable. And we're not doing that. We're allowing partisan political preferences to prevail over the Constitution.
Thanks for being with us, Professor. I've read many of his books. I have most of them in my library. I recommend Get Trump because it's about bigger, and as he articulates well, beyond Trump himself. It's about our rule of law. It's about America. So we'll be right back after the break. Thanks, Professor Dershowitz.
We're ending up the program with a John Arp Show interview on this bank collapse with a expert out of Switzerland. And here we go. We'll just play to the end of this, but we'll embed it on thesecrettruth.com. So come in and you'll be able to see that show, whole show of John Arp. Thank you for listening. Good night.
Hello and welcome to the John Arp Show. Today's episode is called Discussing Upcoming Bank Collapses and Economic Crashes with asset manager and author Matthew Pippenberg. He's a commercial director at Matterhorn Asset Management in Switzerland and the co-founder of SignalsMatter.com in the U.S. He has extensive experience in hedge funds, alternative investments, as well as credit and equity investing. He also has a book out called Rigged to Fail. Before we begin, I want to encourage you to subscribe to our channel for free. You can also like, comment, and follow us. We're going to have a lot of great celebrity interviews coming up, so make sure to click on that notification bell so you can be notified every time we upload a new episode. Also, we ask that you post a link to today's episode of our show on all your social media to help get the word out. Now, let's say hello to Matthew Pippenberg. Hello, Matthew. How are you today, sir?
Very, very well. A little bit tired, a little bit late here compared to your time zone, but lots to talk about. Great to be here.
So, Matthew, I understand that your plane just landed in Paris a few hours ago, and we've been hearing about the growing riots and civil unrest in Paris and throughout France over pension reforms. Did you see any signs of civil unrest coming in from the airport? And what are your thoughts on what Macron is doing with people's pensions?
There's a lot of points layered into that. I mean, it's unique to France. It's a system that really, the retirement, the pension system is very important. It's a quasi-socialist country, and it's they call it the fonctionnaire system, where people who work for many, many years expect a certain pension, they expect a certain benefits, they expect a certain retirement age, and Macron has tried to lift the pension age from 60 to 62 to 64, and that creates a lot of tension for people who work for the SNCF, the trains, the hotels, the any kind of EDF, the electrical systems. Anyone who works for the government or a government kind of sanctioned enterprise is expecting a certain retirement, a certain lifestyle that they've worked many years to have. And when Macron changes that, that creates a lot of social unrest. In terms of between here and the airport, no, but certainly between here and dinner, yeah, you'll see manifestations depending on the day of the week. Sometimes they're preordained, pre-programmed. Sometimes they're spontaneous. The larger question really is, why is there social unrest? Why is there discomfort? It's unique to France and the pension system, but you'll see it in Italy, you'll see it in the UK, you'll see it in New York, you'll see it in San Francisco, you'll see it in Portland. The real problem ultimately is inflation is hurting people, the idea of their job security is hurting people, the idea of their currency is hurting them. There's fear and there's frustration. And as I said so many times, whenever you have a debt crisis, whether it's in France or the US or the ECB or the Fed, whenever you have social, whenever you have a debt crisis, you always have a market crisis, you have a banking crisis, you have a currency crisis, you have social unrest, and then you have more control from the extreme left or right in politics. What we're seeing in France is a unique manifestation of French frustration, but it's very universal.
But it sounds like the good news is nobody threw a bottle of wine or a brick of cheese at your head while you came in.
Not yet.
So Nouriel Roubini just announced on the Drudge Report that in his opinion, most U.S. banks are technically near insolvency and hundreds are already fully insolvent. That would indicate that they're operating in a state of undeclared bankruptcy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, look, just in the U.S. we have, because Powell has raised interest rates, when you raise interest rates, bond prices go down. When bond prices go down on the treasury, whether it's a short term or especially a long duration treasury, the value of those bonds goes down. We've lost across the U.S. banking system $2 trillion in assets. In the small banks, the regional banks, over $600 billion in assets. So on their balance sheets, their liability and asset side of their balance sheets, all U.S. banks have suffered a major loss. To Roubini's point, technically, they're not necessarily insolvent, but they're not profitable. They're not profitable anymore. The Fed has done a great job with the FDIC to try and contain the problems at Silicon Valley Bank or Signature Bank or First Republic. As a small crisis, it's been contained with money printed out of nowhere and at the Treasury to calm the psychological or the public face of the crisis. But if you look under the hood of the details, to Roubini's point, frankly, especially in the smaller banks who have a lot of poor loans on their balance sheet and a lot of discounted treasuries thanks to Powell's monetary policy, technically, these banks are no longer profitable. And so when the treasury bonds or the treasury that's collateral on a lot of these bank balance sheets goes down in price, their loan books are very questionable. But when they go down in price, they're not profitable. And money flows out of these banks into the money markets where you can get more return on a 2-year or 3-year or, you know, even a 4-week T-bill than you can on your checking account or savings account. So these banks have to then increase their depositor rates to keep people in their banks. But that affects their profits. So they have to raise their deposit rates to make their depositors happy. And of course, depositors, if they're smart, we can get more money in a money market. So there's a real risk for the informed to just leave the banks. And that's the biggest fear right now at the U.S. level.
So now we're going to get into some interesting areas. Now you have a very strong understanding of the markets in general, and you also have a lot of experience with the management of ultra high net worth commercial and family investment portfolios. Mm-hmm. Many experts we speak with privately will admit behind closed doors that they've never seen a more corrupt, manipulated, or fraudulent stock, commodities, or crypto market than we have now. How would you evaluate what we're now seeing taking place in the banking sector and in the stock market in the U.S. and abroad?
Well, it's a bubble waiting to pop. It's a bug waiting for a windshield. And again, in all these areas, in the stock, in the risk parity markets, in credit markets, equity markets, real estate markets, and of course in banking sectors, there's so much corruption, fragility, and form over substance. When you look under the hood, and this is not exaggeration, it's not tinfoil hatted, it's just not mainstream, because most people either have their head in the sand or rightfully or wrongfully don't understand these things. And why should they? If you're a plumber, a dentist, a lawyer, a doctor, you have your own things to worry about. You're getting through each month, each week. But if you look at the markets with an experience, and not everyone has that because everyone has different backgrounds, but for those who actually take the time to look under the hood of the balance sheets of the Fed, the U.S. government, or even the banking sector or the bond and stock market, which have been supported for years by a mouse click money. Again, if any business or any family could go down in their basement, push a button and create instant liquidity or instant wealth, who wouldn't be addicted to that? But that's actually counterfeit solutions to a real problem. We have a major debt crisis in the U.S. We have $31 trillion heading towards $33.5 trillion in public government debt in the U.S. And you combine that with household and corporate debt, it's over $90 trillion.